This call is being recorded.
This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. Welcome to our conference call. And today we're discussing issues related to councils of government and planning boards in relation to their work with renewable energy in their areas. So I see we have some interesting people on here. But first, our presenters today is going to be Jen Hill with the Upper Peninsula Association of County Commissioners. She's a consultant for them. And then also Dwayne Baker is with the newly named San Bernardino Council of Governments. So Dwayne, do you want to go ahead and start out and talk a little bit about what's going on in your area, especially in relationship to what you're doing and trying to implement renewable energy?
Certainly. So it gets back to the core of a council of governments, and I'm with San Bernardino Council of Governments. We're east of Los Angeles. We have a population of about 2.1 million people, 24 cities plus the unincorporated county areas. We actually have a 20,000 square mile area, so it's a large geographic county. Most of the populations are centered in certain areas. But the Council of Government, we are working on projects to try to collaborate and have collective action, specifically when we can either save money for our member agencies by doing something together and getting some economies of scale, or being able to bring in expertise that individual cities themselves may not do or may not be able to afford to do on their own. And if we can bring five, six, seven, or more of our cities together at one time to collaborate on a study or on some sustainability work, then it makes it more affordable for them to do. We might be able to find grants to help underwrite it even more. And they are more willing to try something if, you know, some of these cities have very small budgets, and to be able to fit the initial effort, even the initial effort is relatively modest and could be made up by savings on the long term, you still have to have some money up front to do that. And so we try to work with them on that. And some of the programs that we have what's known as a local energy partnership, and that's something that's authorized in California through the Public Utilities Commission, and we work with a number of our cities collaboratively. We provide expertise. We provide to do energy audits of their municipal facilities, to do bring in engineering expertise to help them do specifications for energy efficiency projects. And then if they do those projects through the partnership with the local utilities, they get rebates on their utility bills, depending on the number of kilowatt hours they're able to save. And so if they, you know, convert their HVAC or the motors and pumps for their systems or LED lighting, all those things begin to add up. We track those savings that they have and then apply those to reward them. And then we do some public recognition as well for them. Another program that we've done in the past is try to bring together a number of agencies on solar procurement. And so we put some money forward to help get an expert to come in, do load analysis for each community, and then to try to bundle those and see if we can't do a joint procurement on not only the installation of solar power, but also with the purchase of the power. Now, truth in advertising, at the end of the day, we weren't able to get as many of those agencies to actually commit to the actual program after we did the initial studies. And so we did have a couple of our cities, though, just took the data that we collected through the load analysis, and that they went on and did solar projects on their own. So somewhat of a success, not to the scale that I would have hoped, but that's an example of what we can do as a council of governments. And, of course, we conducted a feasibility study for community choice aggregation for our county, and we actually did that in cooperation with councils of government in the neighboring county of Riverside County, the Western Riverside Council of Governments and Coachella Valley Association of Governments, and presented that information to our board for them to consider. So those are some examples of what we have done collectively to try to encourage renewable projects and encourage sustainability. We have a couple of other projects on the books. We have done a regional greenhouse gas inventory, so that's not necessarily on renewable energy, but that does have to do with sustainable environment, and that's where we came together and did the inventory and a reduction plan for 22 of our 24 cities. And because we did that collectively, because the greenhouse gas inventory was done at one time, everyone had substantial savings in being able to accomplish that, and had were able to share a lot of information with each other on strategies to combat that. And then the final thing is we are getting ready to embark on a regional electric vehicle charging strategy. And this is the idea for this is to identify gaps in the charging network available at public locations throughout our county. And by identifying those gaps, we can focus our efforts on where we need charging infrastructure. And as grant money becomes available here in the state, we think we can be more competitive at trying to bring that grant money to actually install the charging infrastructure throughout our county. So that's just a sort of a highlight of some of the things that we're doing.
Thanks so much. That was a good overview there. And Jen Hill is the Upper Peninsula Association of County Commissioners. Jen, why don't you give a rundown a little bit what's going on up there and what you're trying to do?
All right. I'll start. The Upper Peninsula is 15 counties between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior, attached on the western end to Wisconsin. And we are, I just looked it up, 16,450 square miles. Almost as big as San Bernardino County, but we have our population is total is just about 310,000, and we have a pretty substantial seasonal vacation tourist population as well, both winter and summer. Our region is very, very rural, has primarily been mining and mills as the base. Lumber mills is the base of the economy, and that's changing over time. And so our electricity system was set up for these enormous loads at the iron mines, copper mines, and in the early part of the 1900s. And those primarily coal plants as well as hydro, have been the base of the system for all this time, and our system is aged and not necessarily seen a lot of investment. So at this particular time, with the rapid changes in costs and technology, is a good time to think about how we can meet our current economy's needs with this new technology. The other piece that's important to understand, Michigan passed new energy laws just in December 2016. So they've only been in effect actually since April, so just a couple of months. And we're going through the process right now as a state of figuring out how to implement these, which include a slightly increased renewable portfolio standard. There is going to be a process to determine the cost of solar as we move potentially away from net metering into a new way of valuing solar's value to the grid. We do have some pretty substantial wind developments in the lower peninsula and one in the upper peninsula that's fairly controversial, unfortunately. And then we also have coming by the end of 2018 a study about connecting us to the grid in Ontario, and also which has excess power right now and has already moved away from coal. They moved away from coal in 2016. There's also a study being done at connecting the two peninsulas, the Michigan's upper and lower peninsula, but that's a longer distance to go. So, and these generation questions are important because as we've had the retirements, there's concern that we don't have enough, and since we might not have enough, I should say, power. And because we are literally the end of the line on the transmission, we face a lot of congestion charges. So that all adds up to the most significant issue, which is that parts of the Upper Peninsula pay 26 cents a kilowatt hour for residential use. And those costs are quite a burden to economic development and to folks on fixed incomes and low-income members of the community. So this question of how to plan for a better energy future is being driven as much by mostly by economics, I think, as well as other considerations of environmental regulation and health.
Okay. So we have a number of people here on the call, and I'm just going to go through their names quickly, and then after that, feel free to have a discussion. Kalina Robb's here with Christian Barton. She's an attorney over there. Dottie LaJoy is also from Central Upper Peninsula Planning and Development. And we have Jerry Braun from Integrated Resources Network. Larry Mayer from Solution Design up in North Dakota. Myra Moss from Ohio State University. Randy Mannion, glad to see you, Randy. It's been a while since I've seen you come to these meetings. Western Area Power Authority, Ron Kamen from Earthkind Energy in New York. And Frank Wasco from Clean Coalition. And I have one person here that says, unknown caller, if I didn't call your name, do you want to tell me who you are?
David Kay, Cornell.
Oh, David. All right. Cool. David's one of the newer members of the group, and I'm glad to have you here. So, Cornell University. So anyhow, feel free to ask questions. Some interesting things are going on. It sounds like Upper Peninsula would really like to be doing some of the things that you're doing out there in San Bernardino, Duane. So if you have questions for each other or anybody else has questions, go ahead and start. And please introduce your name before you say anything.
Well, can I say one more thing, Sierra? This is
Sure.
Jen Hill again. Aggregation is not legal in Michigan. So we'll start with that unfortunate piece. And then I will, so we also have all three kinds of utilities. And so the question of how to address these issues when you have municipal utilities and cooperative rural electric co-ops, which are locally controlled and do not have to go in front of the Public Utility Commission. And then we serving large pieces of geography of our region. And then we have three investor-owned utilities that are going in front of the Public Utility Commission. So we are also trying to manage all three at once.
Sounds like quite an endeavor. So anybody, Jerry, do you have any comments about this? You're always good for thinking about outside the box. Or Duane, anyone?
Well, thanks. Thanks, Sierra. Very good summaries. I missed probably the first 5 minutes. Apologize for that. I don't have any questions at this time.
Duane, how about
This is Larry Mayer. Right?
Oh, Larry. Okay, sure.
Yeah, the one comment I have is when for the Upper Peninsula, when you have three different types of power providers. My background is on commercial industrial projects. I'm mostly residential now, but when I worked on those big projects and I would do a large project into an area, those independent utilities a lot of times would cut sweetheart rate deals for their provide customer and keep the load up and thus negate the energy efficiency, and they, because they didn't respond, have to respond to the Public Service Commission, they could play those games, and it was always a challenge to try to get them because they have fixed load requirements in their area and they're not really pushing for energy efficiency. So I'm just wondering what different ideas you've used to try to get them on board.
Well, we've actually have one of our rural electric co-ops folks organized, very small, it's only 5,000 customers. They are working to try to take over the board. Their annual meeting was just 2 weeks ago. So there's, and actually we're not successful because of changes in bylaws with the organization. So yeah, it's, that one's pretty hairy. And then on the, on the others, that's the reason we've moved to the county commissioners as a focus of doing planning and bringing in the planning commission as a set of actors who very much want to respond to the economic development issues. And the zoning questions are complicated because we have townships in Michigan, and so they can have more control over zoning, but the counties also in some cases have control, and Dottie can speak to that more directly. But we're working on, by bringing in those county commissioners, it's the right scale of influence to maybe begin to push some of this decision-making in a more forward-thinking manner.
Right. This is Dottie. I'm just going to chirp in there a little bit. I think, you know, being that we are so rural, I think it really helps having the region involved in being able to bring some of the counties together, because like Jen said, you know, we're so divided. You know, everybody has their own local land use control. You know, we're a home rule state, and that's where councils really are most efficient in just being able to bring those folks together and roll out the concept and the awareness. I mean, we're still pretty, you know, we haven't actually done that. I mean, we're still in the process of pulling all that together. Do I have that right, Jen?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. So we're, you know, we're still in the process of bringing that to the council members. I think I know there's one meeting coming up, but there seems to be a lot of support so far for those folks that have been in on it. I will say this too about this initiative, is it really sort of started out as a grassroots initiative for climate change. Do I have that right, Jen?
Right.
Is that, yeah.
That was some, that and then the complexities of our energy system.
Right. So, and that just sort of then dovetailed to county commissioners, because actually it was an ex-county commissioner that wanted to get a real leader in the county addressing climate adaptation strategies, and then it then developed into regional planning, becoming more active and taking a role in their influence. Influencing larger portions of the county. So, I mean, I'm sorry, of the Upper Peninsula.
Duane, do you have any thoughts about how they might move forward with that?
Well, yeah, as they were talking, not knowing the details of it, of the politics and the demography of the Upper Peninsula, the only thing I can point to, some of the lessons I have learned here in trying to move any project forward, and we have in our part of California, unlike what it's a rather conservative corner of the state, and in some parts of the state, the message is that we want to do sustainability for sustainability's sake, because it has a broader, the policy goals and ends are the objective. That does not do as well here in San Bernardino County, although in some cities it does, but not all of them. And so I have to find the common denominator that they can all agree to. And so our case, typically when we make them, have been economic cases, that we are doing this because there is an economic reason to do it for your community. Oh, and by the way, there is also an environmental advantage to doing these certain things. And we sort of had to take that message, because trying to get as much buy-in from a rather diverse county, in we have cities that are much more in tune to the message and of sustainability, and others that think that that is just something that they, as a local government, should not even be concerned about.
So what are some of your economic arguments?
Well, in those cases where we can talk about how, in some cases, there are mandates placed on local governments by the state, and whether or not my cities like it or not becomes immaterial. It becomes a mandate. And so if we can do some of this in a way that you're saving money to comply, then that makes sense. I mean, you're foolish to throw money away if you don't have to, if we can save some money doing it. And then the other is just looking at the economic argument of how clean energy or green energy, there are benefits over what is being provided by other providers. And so if we can try to make that case to them, say, look, here's how the real dollars and cents, or in efficiency improvements, here are the real dollars and cents, and try to be able to give them numbers to demonstrate them, And sometimes that means we put a little money in to help get the expertise necessary to do that. It's just not hearsay. And then when they see the actual numbers, that helps.
Do you have any figures on that anywhere that people could see?
What specifically? what figures specifically?
Anything related to the economic value of energy efficiency or renewable energy? Anybody?
Oh, I
think Sherry Gruder, I think, had some of that, didn't she, in the last one of the earlier conference calls? Or was that you, Myra? Myra, are you still with us?
Sorry, I had my muted. I believe that was Sherry.
Okay. Yeah, we have to go ahead.
Sorry, it's Jen. At our second meeting of this group, just the beginning of this year, we had an interesting conversation where the county commissioners started, you know, kind of bragging about the different efficiency projects that they have put in place, which I certainly encouraged to get them to start to take ownership and move those ideas, you know, really communicate about the value of efficiency, because, you know, so often that's not seen as the first thing that people think about in terms of energy. It usually goes to generation. And then one of them actually said how hard it was for him as an elected official to vote to spend money with only a promise of saving money, but not, you know, not quite that guarantee. And that led to an interesting conversation about how, as elected officials, yeah, when they're making these kinds of investments, that sense that they're taking a risk with public dollars. And so, yeah, we're working, as our first goal actually is to compile examples of all the counties of how they've installed energy efficiency. And believe me, at 26 cents a kilowatt hour, most of them have seen an advantage to doing this. But then I'm hoping to be able to put all that together and then we probably put it up on the, I'm hoping we could, we're working with another regional agency, one of them, or QPAD or the regional planning agencies, we'd get that story up and be able to share it.
So Randy, do you have anything to say on this, or Frank Wasco?
Hi, Sarah, I don't. This is Randy.
Okay. Frank, how about you?
No, nothing to add, Sarah.
This is Larry. I was just going to ask, have you set or have you done enough research to find out what target lower cost of energy you'd have to get to, or what improvements in energy efficiency you'd have to get to in order for a commercial piece of property to attract a new business to come into the Upper Peninsula?
That's a really good question. No. What QPAD Dottie's group has done is one-on-one assistance with current businesses, manufacturing particular, to actually sit down and go through their bill with them and help them understand that maybe they could be saving money, that really just basic on-the-ground work. I'm not quite sure what you mean by target energy efficiency, though.
I would like to hear more about that, Larry.
If you were to go out, you know, 300-400 mile radius, you know, what are the commercial or manufacturing businesses, what are they paying for cost of energy? Because I know energy intensive industry is looking for the lowest cost markets to work in, and that would give you some kind of reference point of saying, you know, we're twice what these types of businesses are going for, but yet there's other businesses that there are ways to use energy efficiency and how that plant is built that we can get them to be willing to move up into the Upper Peninsula, because we can through a combination of rate reductions by putting in solar or windmills or whatever, we can now create a competitive environment where we can attract businesses into our market area. That's why I just.
We do have a study. This is Dottie. We did put together a study as far as capacity at various industrial sites throughout the central region. But this is interesting to just kind of play that backwards here and see what they're actually paying and what they're, you know, what we could do to bring that down to, you know, to a more desirable cost. So, yeah,
right,
we haven't done that yet.
Okay. To me, it would just seem that if you want your business to stay viable and if you sell your products to a much wider region, you, and in essence, where you sell your products to are potential competitor areas, you know, and if their cost of energy is at a certain low, it allows you to more focus what you're trying to accomplish.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Ron, you have any comments or thoughts about this? Ron Kamen or Dave, David King?
I could ask a couple questions. This is David
sure.
K. of Cornell. One of them is, I think I'm hearing each of you talking primarily about the local government policy being focused on the cost of energy to the business community. The councils of governments I'm familiar with around here care about that, but they probably care even more about their tax burdens and costs of government per se. And I wonder if you could comment on the extent to which I'm misreading you or whether there's some more of the story to tell about the cost of government itself.
This is Duane at SB COG. In our case, my policymakers were concerned about end rates that could be charged to residential users through community choice aggregation. That was a big thing, and also to the effect that the commercial users could have a benefit as well. But then the rest of the programs are actually have been involved when we're talking about like the local energy partnership. That is specifically focused on the municipal users themselves. So to the extent that they put efficiencies, improvements in City Hall, the public library, the fire stations, the rec center, and how that will bring the overall cost of government down in their community. That's something of concern, and that's the big selling point, that if they, through the partnership, if they participate, they can get further, not only will they get the efficiency savings, but they'll get rebates from the investor-owned utility.
So it is a mix then. Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Ron, any thoughts?
So a question. In New York and elsewhere, you know, there's a big drive. It's a little parallel subject to electric vehicles and electrification of the transportation system as a way of both saving money with 50% or better reductions in fuel when you go to electric. And then also in New York with the REV program, the Reform of the Energy Vision, that if you have increased electric vehicle penetration and you drive those electric vehicles to charging at night during the off-peak, you increase the flow through by more kilowatt hours going through the system at a time when the system can handle a lot more kilowatt hours and energy is cheap, and therefore you make this shift to electric vehicles with evening charging, and it uses the system better and increases the benefits for all consumers because there's more usage on the system and more revenues being generated when there's off-peak. I don't know if that's true in the municipalities we're talking to or if anybody's looking at that, and if there's an electrification of transportation initiative going on, and I'd be interested to hear.
Well, my first question is, do you know if that's happening in the most northern parts of New York? Because that's the challenge of the minus 20 degree winter nights. We do still have those here. Maybe not as many, but they are that question of electric vehicle utility in the cold times.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely it's coming. It's definitely starting, like in New York City in urban areas where there's great concentration, very little mileage, and a lot of sitting still. Or I mean, 90% of trips being less than 30 miles is the first criteria, which is the average for Americans. So in the north country, the northernmost hit the lands, it's probably one of the last places we're going to see electrification. But even there, the battery technology is evolving. We're seeing 18% cost reductions year over year, 40 to 70% annual growth in the home market, 30 different manufacturers now having electric vehicles, new products on the market every year. So we're seeing that, you know, step by step it's going to get there, but absolutely it's going to hit areas that are densely concentrated and not with not such temperature extremes. So I'm sure it's difficult there. Just to answer your question.
And I can speak, certainly Michigan as a state, of course, home of the big three. I was just at our Michigan conference on Saturday, and we want everyone to buy electric vehicles. We're very excited about that on a statewide basis. You know, go buy that Bolt when it becomes available in your region. We'd love for you to do that. And I just heard our second largest utility, which serves over 2 million customers, Detroit Edison, their CEO spoke and said that they did see an uptick when the Chevy Volt came on the system. They could register how much more energy was being requested by those vehicles. And they're estimating that 100,000 vehicles is the equivalent of a city of about 30,000. So there is definitely an opportunity there, and it's planning for that future. It's just that up here in the Upper Peninsula, we have a lot more in common with Watertown, say, in that part of New York than down south. But that also does make me think about what are the potentials for electrification of some of the municipal vehicles. We do have electric charging stations here in Marquette, the largest city. We have two, and there's one person in town who owns a Tesla who's pretty much always plugged in there.
There's no doubt that the changes like the iPhones before us and the cell phones and other technology adoptions, you know, happen in its own way, in its own time, in different places. But the interesting thing, I'm working with 42 municipalities in Westchester, and what we found is that the electrification can save them 50% to two-thirds of their fuel costs. There's basically very little maintenance. You're looking at 20 moving parts versus 2,000 in an internal combustion engine. So very little maintenance, no oil changes, no transmission changes. And yeah, there's the battery issues at this point, but those keep evolving. And if you have the right strategy, you can input where it makes sense for sedans and other vehicles that are only going short distances, you know, pretty much less than 100 miles is, you know, pretty standard, right? I mean, if you're doing 100 miles a day, it's, 30,000 miles a year. So most people are doing a third of that or a quarter of that, and 90% of trips it can work for. So it really depends, and you got to look at each type of vehicle and what you're using it for. But that first step is starting to happen. And after the first step, we're going to see an escalation, I believe, into many other steps. And municipalities leading the way, I believe, is very helpful.
This is Duane in San Bernardino, and one of the things that's driving electric vehicle adoption rates here and will drive it even more is actually air quality. We have had an air quality management district in the Southern California Basin for a few decades, and they've done everything they can with stationary sources, you know, dry cleaners, auto paint shops, oil refineries, those kinds of things. And the marginal cost to get the next increment of air quality improvement gets higher and higher as they ratchet down the regulation. But really, the largest component is mobile sources and cars. And in order to meet our goals, a substantial portion of the fleet is going to have to transition to electric vehicles simply to meet air quality regulations here in Southern California. And how best to do that and how that comes about, between a combination of incentives to get people to transition or just the market forces by themselves. So it's a fascinating thing, and it's beginning to play out now. We are involved in cooperation with the California Air Resources Board in piloting an electric battery truck program here at the rail yard next to our offices in this logistics depot. And so we are helping underwrite through this grant the development of a battery electric drayage truck to help move the containers around the rail yard to replace diesel, and doing an analysis of that to help improve commercialization of those kinds of technologies.
Could I follow up with a question about that? Is this statewide policy or Southern California or local? And I'm asking that in the context, if you're saying it's driven by air quality regulations, I assume you're talking about traditional local air quality. And I know that there's enormous potential. I'm asking because I know there's enormous potential for reducing greenhouse gas emissions when electrification of the vehicle fleet is simultaneous with moving off of fossil fuels, but there's also a potential for getting ahead of the curve and actually increasing fossil fuel use through electrification if it's not coordinated. So I'm wondering how much this is really driven by what used to be called smog concerns, NOx and SOx and things like that, or about carbon itself.
Well, the state is really the state California Resources Board is driving it based on the greenhouse gas regulations. However, the benefits to the particulate and NOx and SOx, as you said, is something that the local air quality board here in the Los Angeles region is deeply concerned about. So those are sort of meshing together to drive that. And of course, you couple that with the statewide policy here in California to continue to increase the renewable portfolio that the investor-owned utilities have to provide to the users, coming up on 30% and moving to 50%. There's even talk amongst some in the legislature about trying to set an aspirational target of 100%. That isn't regulation yet, but the 50% is. And so couple that with EV adoption and you see some of the environmental benefits they're trying to do on a statewide basis.
Can I ask one more follow-up then in relation to that to everybody, which is on the generation side about facility siting and how because I'm in New York and we're starting to see more and more opposition at the local level to renewable facilities, and I'm just wondering whether that's not an issue in Michigan or California or whether it is an issue.
Well,
I can speak to it. Oh.
Go ahead.
In Michigan, again, we have local township level zoning control, and we have seen what we're calling wind fatigue of the turbines, because there's a couple of places that are of where the highest potential is. And then there's other, we're seeing that if we can locate it in primarily agricultural regions, it's a much easier sell. And the most successful program we have, it's right in the middle of the Lower Peninsula. 2 years of one-on-one coffee table conversations before the project was the project permit process began to build those relationships and to set up a zoning system where the entire county had the same zoning. The big fights have been in places where it's not just agricultural but also tourism, particularly our coastal areas, and that has been a much more difficult fight, and we're working right now. There's a coalition to promote the fact that those regions that do have wind have seen 30% increases in taxable value of their communities and the amount of investment that has then come from that, because it's money coming from outside their region. Those turbines are being, the power is being purchased for metro areas that are, 100, 200 miles away. And so that's money coming into the region to support investment in those regions. But that story has not been told well till now, because we have lost some significant cases, including a $30 million investment with contracts already signed and then zoning changed, and that contract had to be canceled.
In
about
Southern
California.
Our county in particular encompasses large portions of the Mojave Desert, and we've had utility scale solar projects developed And we're beginning, from our residents, we're beginning to get some resistance on a couple of fronts. One is an environmental concern of just the impact to whether it's the view shed or just the habitat for certain species, and whether or not they're being mitigated properly, or whether the sites themselves are being sited properly, not only for the collectors, but also for any transmission lines that have to be built. Mm-hmm. And there's some concern. And then local residents are beginning to push back because, one, that they are seeing these impacts in their communities. And oftentimes for the utility scale solar projects that are going in, the benefit is not directed at the local community. The power is for Los Angeles or another large urban area elsewhere in the state. These plants, after the construction is done, don't really provide employment opportunity. It doesn't take many people to operate them. And so there's that concern on those two levels is happening. And so there's a lot of discussion now about the proper siting and how, you know, just because you have a lot of desert land doesn't mean it's prime by in and of itself for development of that. So there's a lot of that discussion going on. Some of it is revolving around maybe we do smaller scale solar that actually benefits a local community as well as a broader market for electricity. Or maybe, you know, we're looking at having to just be restricted to disturbed lands only to help ameliorate some of the environmental habitat concerns. So that is happening. There is some pushback going on at the local level in those communities that are out in our deserts.
Have people been, sorry to dominate this, but have been people looking at the consistency of making those kinds of policy changes you just mentioned and the ability to reach the state's pretty far-sighted goals, like you mentioned 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's gotten to the point where these concerns have yet caused anyone to doubt that we'll have the ability to reach the target, the renewable targets that the state has set, because those can come from, you know, those don't have to be generated within the state. They can come from wind sources and other renewable resources other than solar, but certainly at some point it could come into conflict. That's not dominating that discussion yet.
Thank you.
This is Myra Moss from Ohio. It sounds like we're in a very similar situation to Michigan, although we do allow aggregation in Ohio. But a question I've got is, one of our major investor-owned utilities, American Electric Power, just sought proposals for up to 250 megawatts of wind energy and 100 megawatts of solar energy. And where they're planning to locate these are, you know, basically in a portion of Ohio is Appalachian. And those are the areas that they've reached out to landowners to see if there's any interest in leasing and developing those kinds of, not developing, but leasing for those kinds of development. So I was curious if anything's happening in Michigan in terms of your investor-owned utilities or even your co-ops making major commitments to solar or wind generation facilities.
Yeah, our two investor-owned utilities each serve just over 2 million people, and they're the ones who've been investing significantly, particularly in wind. Although there's also, what I understand, the largest solar east of the Mississippi is going in just east of Flint. I'm trying to remember, 300,000, I think he said, solar panels going in. So, yeah, significant. And, in fact, at this event, Detroit Edison announced that they did the math and they are going to meet every one of the commitments of the Clean Power Plan because it made financial sense for them. That was the big kickoff moment of our meeting, is that the utility is making that commitment and to meet 80% reduction by 2050 in emissions. And Consumers Energy is also doing as much. They didn't have a big announcement to make, but they've been also steadily closing their coal plants and investing in wind and solar. Here in the Upper Peninsula, in a more rural location, that controversial wind I talked about is actually built as a with a power purchase agreement to send power to have renewable credits for DTE as well. So the investor owns have been on top of this, I think, driven in part by the Clean Power Plan, but now clearly driven by economics. And then here in Marquette, we have a Air Force base that closed in 1991 with a B-52 bomber base since World War II. And that location, of course, has significant infrastructure, and there has been 100 megawatts of solar proposed for that location that would be managed by the county, which has retains right of the land. It was county forest land right next to the airport. And that project could potentially power the equivalent of 20,000 homes. The trick is getting the utility to purchase the power. So and that's an investor-owned utility in that location. So I know those conversations are happening.
Okay, I've got another question too, and that is, do you work at all, are you seeing much movement with local companies who are interested in maybe installing rooftop solar? Do you do any work with companies in terms of return on investment for solar energy?
I'm not immediately familiar with that. I do know I can speak to the financial innovations that are being put in place as policy by government, like the PACE, the property assessment, so that those improvements can be tied to the property and paid back over a longer period of time. And then Michigan also recently allowed on-bill financing for municipal utilities, again, because it's tied to property. And so those innovations, and then we also have something called Michigan Saves, which is something of a revolving loan fund to statewide, where banks have access to a guarantee to banks and savings and loans, I should say. Our credit unions are also part of that, where there's financing available at favorable terms without having to put up an asset in return because of that guarantee. I forgot the financial name for that, but. Again, trying to help those small businesses access financing to do this. It's a big part of the equation, of course, a big, huge part of the equation. And so the PACE financing, the on-bill financing, and which isn't as much about the interest rate itself as it is extending those payments over time.
Lena, do you have anything to add to this conversation?
I don't. I'm really enjoying it.
Is Virginia?
I will say just in Virginia that the utilities are now starting to step in with renewable power, mostly for economic reasons. They used to blame it on the Clean Power Plan. Now they're a little more honest about it makes economic sense. And so one of the issues in Virginia is whether that's and they're also trying to shut down access by customers to renewable power from other sources. So that's a tension that's coming up in Virginia.
Now, the utilities are adding some of their own renewables as well?
Yes, they're adding a bunch of solar and wind is still a bit of an issue in Virginia, but they're trying to do some land wind. They've Dominion has pretty much abandoned the offshore wind, much to the dismay of a lot of people around here. And then they're trying to file tariffs that will basically block customers from purchasing any renewable power from any third-party supplier.
I have a question for Jen or Dottie. Marquette and Escanaba are on the lakes, various lakes. And the question is, are they ports as well, so that you might encourage a wind manufacturing plant of some sort that could be able to transmit by the lakes, because I know the transmission of these large turbines is one of the major issues for wind.
Well, we,
do you want to take that one, Jen?
Yeah, I can answer that for we compete with Duluth, and Duluth, Minnesota has more access, I think, and more access to bigger markets than we do, to be honest. And they'd probably go to Green Bay before they would come to us. But what we are trying to do, because of the connection to Finland that we have here, very strong Finnish roots in the Upper Peninsula, one of the primary makers of the reciprocating natural gas engines that are becoming the industry standard, that because they can turn off and turn on so quickly, is a Finnish company named Wärtsilä, and they are working to make us one of the distribution centers for that, because it's not uncommon to find someone here who knows how to speak Finnish, which is a very obscure, pardon me, I'm not Finnish, a relatively obscure language. There's lots of demand for those engines to go in to replace the coal.
Interesting. Yes, I taught school in Upper Michigan, and I couldn't pronounce anybody's name.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all unpronounceable. So anyhow.
Do you know what's any of the port planning, Dottie? I don't know about that.
Well, I know Escanaba has a large draft port. You know, we do as far as the power plant, the Presque Isle power plant, and both power plants, actually. I mean, the ore boats come to it, but we don't take, when they did drop off those big, what do you call them, reciprocating engines, natural gas
right.
engines?
RICE,
yeah.
Not engines.
That was a real big deal logistically, you know, because we just don't have the capacity. I mean, they're all set up to receive iron ore pellets for the Presque Isle power plant that's coal operated and then transports or we ship out iron ore pellets from our mining. But when it comes to anything else, we really don't have the capacity to bring other things into our port, even cruise ships.
Yeah.
Hmm. Anybody else? Any comments? We're going to wrap it up here pretty quickly.
No.
Nope. Everybody good? Okay. Well, we're going to have a webinar in July 25th. Barrett Brown will be talking about microgrids and microgrid regulatory and financing strategies. And Barrett's an attorney. He's been at that for many, many years. He's one of the top experts in the country in the areas of financing renewable energy. So anyhow, hope to see you all then. Anybody have any comments about this, you know, send me an email and we'll correspond. Thanks for coming, and I hope to see you all next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great session.